World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
It was exactly 192 weeks ago that the American people learned that war had come to the United States. At 2:30 Eastern wartime, on that Sunday afternoon of December 7th, 1941, the news came. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. And now it's 2:30 in the afternoon of a different Sunday, 3 years and 8 months later. Almost 4 years of work and struggle, of grief and failure, and later, success. Nearly 4 years, and for all our principal allies, the ordeal has been longer still. The days that followed the news of that other Sunday were black and filled with peril. Perhaps the decision of victory or defeat was closer than many Americans yet realize. But it's been a long time now since the cause of the United Nations was desperate and the days were black. The recent months have been crowded with brilliant success as well as with pain for many. And the days that are to follow this Sunday, so different from that other December afternoon, represent the great opportunity which was bought at so high a price. Whether Sunday, August the 12th, 1945, is to be written into the records as the day the Second World War ended, we do not yet know. All the world outside Japan still waits to learn the enemy's decision. The suspense is caused not by doubt of the answer, which the Japanese must almost certainly make, but by the uncertainty of the time and the method which the Japanese will choose to announce their final renunciation of the evil ambition which has led the world through the paths of misery and has led Japan at last to ruin. In Washington, President Truman reached his office in the White House before 8:30 in the morning. The correspondents have waited impatiently since then for some announcement, but none has come. In England, Prime Minister Attlee left his country home to return to London today and is now at number 10 Downing Street, but the reporters in Britain also are waiting in the same state of suppressed excitement that has gripped their colleagues in Washington since breakfast time. It was news today when Secretary of State James Burns entered his office saying nothing. It was news when Secretary Burns left his office 2 hours ago and went home for lunch. The fact that no one in the Swiss legation had any definite appointment with anyone in the State Department would not be worth mentioning on an ordinary day, but on this day, that too was news and was duly reported. The waiting world learned through the dragging hours of the morning and early afternoon that the statesmen were also waiting, and while waiting, were not talking. In Moscow, Premier Stalin climbed to the top of Lenin's tomb with his guest, General Eisenhower, and for 2 hours, the two men reviewed 25,000 Russian athletes who marched through Red Square in the first such parade since 1940. From Chongqing, there was little information of Chiang Kai-shek's activities, merely a report that the Generalissimo is considering heading the Chinese delegation, which will accept a Japanese surrender when it comes. From Japan, there were various reports. The Japanese transmitters are working as usual. They're broadcasting a few claims of Allied ships they say they have sunk off Okinawa, and a few admissions of the failure of the Japanese Kwantung Army, whose formidable reputation is being torn to shreds by the Red Banner armies of Russia, which are grinding deeper into Manchuria. The editorials of the Tokyo Sunday newspapers did not speak directly of surrender. So far, the Japanese people have not been informed by either radio or newspaper that total defeat is near. But today's Tokyo papers spoke gloomily of the war. In vague terms, the editorials appealed for absolute obedience to the emperor and urge the Japanese people, above all, to retain their unity in order to achieve their goal someday in the future. It all sounded very familiar. 3 months ago, the German newspapers, the German officials, were using the same words, appealing to the German people to remain united during the crisis in order to fight and win another day. And so, the waiting goes on. And now, our first switch abroad. For a report from Fleet and Super Fortress Headquarters, Admiral takes you to CBS Guam, Webley Edwards reporting.
So here's a Sunday again. And now on this Sunday that peace seems possible, I look back 192 Sundays ago when I was there. I remember that morning at Pearl Harbor like it was yesterday. I remember the blackness in our hearts as the bombs fell and the Jap planes roared down the highways and straight automobiles to pile them up in broken heaps. I remember the smugness and cockiness of the enemy. He'd been pretty smart, all right. He'd caught us napping. He struck with the sneak blow and he hurt us bad. We hadn't been ready. And he found that out all through the Pacific as he spread out south and east, as far south as New Guinea, as far east as the Gilberts and Kiska and Attu. I remember the heartbreaking job that stretched out like some painful obstacle race before our leaders and the men who were to go with them. And I remember the weary, dreary early days of the war when we knew we didn't have quite enough, but with that not quite enough, we had to do it anyway. And then the fight back across the Pacific, while priority was given, and wisely we see now, to the war in Europe. Back across the mountains of New Guinea and painfully up its coast, the early carrier strikes at the outer fringe of Jap Islands. Then the Solomons, Guadalcanal, and Tulagi, and the rest. And then one day, Tarawa, the spearhead into the outer armor of Japan, and the big push was on. Well, that morning at Pearl Harbor seems like yesterday. It's been a long, hard trail back across this Pacific Ocean. There are plenty of white crosses on the way. Countless hours spent by lonely, weary men whose aim in life was to work at their jobs and live with their families. And of all those fellows who went along to report it all, the war correspondents, there are a few of them missing, too. Jack Singer on the carrier, Ace Bush from the Bombed Lady, Bill Chickering on the warship at Ling Dien, and Damien Ferrer in the dusty heat of Peleliu, and Ernie Pyle along the roadside of Hiroshima by Okinawa. You have a thought for those good, sweet guys in this hour and wish they may have lived to be here for it. So you and all these tired and worn fellows out here just sit here for a minute and rest. All at once, you hope it's relief and relaxation from tension of war. This is Webley Edwards at Guam. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney.
If you want good looks in your next radio or radio phonograph, you'll certainly appreciate the luxurious beauty of the post-war Admiral cabinets. From the least expensive Admiral table model to the finest radio phonograph with automatic record changer, the traditional beauty of Admiral cabinets will add charm to any room in your home. Admiral will give you modern designs in plastics and fine woods, and there'll be authentic period reproductions to complement your individual furniture styling. There'll be new beauty of tone, too, in your post-war Admiral, new high-fidelity performance to make your listening pleasure complete. There'll be new Admiral electronic refinements in AM, FM, and shortwave reception, plus the famous Admiral automatic record changer that will change records in 5 seconds. So for graceful cabinet beauty and styling, for clear, natural reception, for fine record reproduction, and smooth, fast record changing, choose an Admiral, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Robert Trout.
The White House has told us that an American will be appointed to the position of Supreme Allied Commander in the Pacific. To discuss this, here is Major George Fielding Elliott.
As we wait for news of the Japanese decision, we have a good many uncertainties. We know, for example, that the Japanese surrender must be made to the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces. We know this officer will be an American, but we don't know who he will be. The weight of informed opinion in Washington tends to the belief that the choice will fall on General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. He's the senior American officer in the Pacific by reason of the position assigned him on the list of five-star generals and admirals, though Fleet Admiral Nimitz also has 5 stars. General MacArthur is the commander of all American Army forces in the Pacific, and the occupation of conquered territory is a job for an army and not for a navy. General MacArthur has had longer service in the Pacific than any other American officer now serving there, and is probably better known to our allies. He seems to be favored by most of the comment received from British sources. He's served in Australia and is well known to the government and people of that country, so deeply concerned in the decisions now being taken. His brilliant campaigns, fighting his way upwards from New Guinea to the Admiralty Islands, to the Pelews, and then on to the liberation of the Philippines entitle him to great consideration. But there are some observers in Washington who take the view that on the basis of present accomplishments, the Navy is entitled to the great honor of receiving the surrender of the Japanese emperor. These observers point out that no invasion of Japan has as yet taken place. That up to that point, the Navy has had to do the lion's share of the hard work and a great deal of the fighting, especially if we include the work of the Marines. That MacArthur's troops would never have moved from one point to another and wouldn't be in the Philippines today if it were not for the Navy, which brought them there, put them ashore, and protected their lines of supply. These observers point to the great naval battles of Midway, the Santa Cruz Islands, Guadalcanal, and the two battles of the Philippines. They point to the work of the Marines at Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Peleliu, Saipan, and Iwo Jima. They consider the work of the carrier aircraft of the fleet in giving the original tactical air support to all our landings. They say that MacArthur's big job was the actual invasion of Japan, but since that has not happened, a surrender at this time should be made to a naval officer, obviously to Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz. But the most recent advices from Washington suggest that this view will not prevail and that General MacArthur will have the assignment. If this decision is made, there's no way to tell whether it will or not adversely affect Admiral Halsey's prospect of riding the Emperor's white horse. Now here again is Robert Trout.
Japanese troops in China, perhaps a total of 500,000, face a giant trap today. Tokyo reports that Russian forces have opened a massive new drive into Manchuria that threatens to split the enemy troops in Asia into two huge pockets. The command headquarters of the Japanese Kwantung Army in Manchuria says that Soviet troops striking from Outer Mongolia across Chinese Inner Mongolia are now driving toward the Yellow Sea, northwest of Beiping, which is the ancient capital of China. The Red Army drive threatened to isolate China from Manchuria by tearing a gap in the once-vaunted Tokyo to Singapore express communication line supplying enemy troops in the Asiatic mainland. This drive, if successful, would cut into two pockets the million Japanese troops in China or Manchuria. The Chinese people have already celebrated the unofficial victory. For a report from our correspondent in China, Admiral takes you to Chungking, Don Pryor reporting.
It's 10:30 Monday morning here to get the word on Japan's final surrender. So far, it hasn't come. But meanwhile, China's dormant dispute between the national government and the northern communists has broken out again. And everywhere you hear ugly talk about civil war or revolution, whichever you like to call it. The latest outbreak began 2 days ago when General Zhu De, commander of the 18th Health Army in Yunnan, the communists, publicized an order to his troops, telling them to accept the surrender of Japanese forces to occupy Jap-held cities and communication centers and to take over Japanese arms. At first, the news was suppressed by the censors here in Chongqing, but agencies in the United States picked it up by radio from Yunnan, the communist capital. Today, a spokesman for the Chinese Ministry of Information issued a statement warning that the Chinese government would hold Japan accountable for any arms turned over to the communists or other forces not authorized by Chongqing. And several hours ago, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek himself issued a special order to the 18th Group Army's commander, ordering him to keep his troops at their present posts and to wait for further instructions. He told them that all Chinese troops had been given the same order and warned them never again to take independent action. The Generalissimo used the word warned in his order to the communist generals, so presumably he was prepared to back it up with force if necessary. Now the question is whether the communists will heed his warning and what might happen in China if they should not. There's no doubt that China is on the verge of great events affecting her whole future. For her, Japanese surrender will be merely the end of one phase of her struggle for a united nationhood. This is Don Pryor in Chongqing. I return you to Admiral in New York.
The British people have been going through the same waiting period that we've experienced in this country. For a report on what Britain is thinking and doing, Admiral takes you now to CBS London.
There has been no announcement yet in London. For hours now, we've been expecting one practically any moment. But there's been complete silence. We don't know what the delay is, or even whether there is a specific delay. When the announcement comes, the effect in Britain will be tremendous. I don't think that there'll be much spectacular enthusiasm through the country. Britain blew its top on German Victory Day for the end of a campaign that was more intimate and more dramatic to it. But when word comes of the end of World War II, it will strike a note of deep thanksgiving in every heart. It'll mean the end of almost 6 years of death and worry that have not missed a single family. Out in the Pacific right now, Britain has large forces of her fleet. More and more of her air forces there are on the way. Hundreds of thousands of troops are in India and Southeast Asia. They will be safe. In Japanese hands, there are still about 140,000 British military and civilian prisoners. They were caught up in the tidal wave of war in 1942 when it seemed the entire empire would crumble. And Britain prays they will be safe. And the best of all, most of them will return, because the task of occupying Japan and Manchuria will fall mainly to Russia and China and the United States. In Britain, conversion from war to peace production and war to peacetime living can really get going. As everywhere else, it'll bring great social and economic changes because the discipline of war will be relaxed. There'll be a widespread demand that the problems of peace be tackled as vigorously and uncompromisingly as the crises of war. The fact that the war is ending now and not months later may be a blessing to the people of all of Europe. A winter of starvation and death is threatening. Ships needed to bring food and supplies have been frozen for war needs in the Pacific. If the war ends, they can be released. Trucks and cars still in Europe, earmarked for shipment to the Pacific, can be released too for civilian needs and immediately. This continent, saturated with death and trouble, prays that the gifts of peace will quickly follow its declaration. This is Richard C. Hoddlett in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
Washington has been the scene of reports and rumors through the night and morning. One of our correspondents has been waiting in the White House for some indication of when we may expect the Japanese reply. For his report, Admiral takes you now to the CBS mobile transmitter on the White House grounds, Tris Coffin reporting.
Up to the time I left the press room a moment ago, there was no evidence that a Japanese reply has been received in Washington. However, the White House is expecting a decisive break. We will all be told the full story when it comes. Most of the correspondents here believe Mr. Truman will personally announce the end of the war when it comes and speak to the world over the radio. President Truman arrived at his desk at 7:45 this morning and has been there ever since. He missed his customary Sunday visit to church so that he might be on hand if important news should come from Japan. One drowsy White House secretary called the telephone operator here just before 8 o'clock. Yes, what was happening? The telephone girl reported cheerfully, "Nothing. Mr. Truman is at work as usual." Together with some 100 or more Washington correspondents, who by this time are both sleepy and hungry, I have been keeping a watch on the White House since early morning. The president's staff began assembling after 8. Admiral Leahy, the president's chief of staff. Judge Samuel Rosenman, the man who helps write important White House documents. Matt Connelly, the presidential secretary. Fatherly White House assistant Bill Hassett, and the rest. Secretary of State James F. Burns came to work at 10:15, driving his own car. He has not been to the White House. Tension and rumor ebbs and flows like the beating of a giant heart. Is the war over? You can get 8 different answers in whispered conversations with 8 different people. Have the Japs answered Secretary Burns' statement? Yes and no, depending on whom you talk. But all the weight of evidence here suggests that the Japanese have not replied to Washington. White House spokesmen are keeping their lips buttoned, and you can hardly blame them. Their very inflections are reported and commented on. They see and hear themselves quoted glibly, to their surprise, on practically every subject. But this always happens when a lot of impatient reporters are waiting for a big story to break. It was the same story on the VE Day death watch. One of the correspondents tried an experiment. In a loud voice, he said he had heard that the Mikado had committed suicide. An hour later, the rumor had traveled through the White House to the outside. His office called him to check on the rumors. But the press room now is a little calmer than it was this morning. The phones are not ringing all the time, just half the time. The correspondents are not racing and skidding across the floor. They've slowed down to a fast walk. The only people who seem to have any faith that the war is over are the curious Sunday crowds in Lafayette Square. The people are sitting on the lawn or crowding around the transmitter. Yesterday at this time, the atmosphere in the White House was different than it is now. Then everyone was confident that the Japs would accept Mr. Burns' ultimatum. Now we are not all quite so sure. You might reason it out this way. The White House was expecting to make some announcement this morning. The hours have dragged on. There is not the slightest sign at this moment that the president will have any special announcement very soon. But Presidential Secretary Charlie Ross has not put the lid on, as he did last night. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a report from France. Admiral takes you now to CBS Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Like the rest of the world, France is waiting for the announcement of the end of the war with Japan.
They regard it as a foregone conclusion, and there is no atmosphere of tension in the French capital. American troops, hoping that the end of the Pacific War will mean that they'll go home more quickly, are somewhat more excited. But they, too, are taking it all very casually. The French are deeply interested in the Far East. They have asked for, and they think that they will receive, a place among the nations who will fix a settlement with Japan. The French are particularly anxious to regain Indochina. There have been fears expressed that Britain and America might try to take it away. But in a speech yesterday, General de Gaulle said that he was sure that Indochina would return to France. This speech of General de Gaulle's was a remarkable one. De Gaulle, like Winston Churchill in the dark days of Britain, has never tried to fool his people with glowing pictures and easy promises. But yesterday, the head of the French government breathed confidence and hope in the future. In spite of obstacles and deceptions, he said, we are in the act of accomplishing a remarkable recovery. And he cited figures to show what he meant. Coal production, double what it was at the time of the liberation. Electricity, equal to 1938. Car loadings, three times what they were in November of last year. Yes, I affirm it, General de Gaulle cried. France, wounded, wiped out, humiliated, has taken up her march ahead. The Pétain trial is still on in Paris. The judge, the jury, and the whole nation are trying to decide not only whether Pétain is guilty of treason, but what were the basic causes of France's downfall. All the witnesses have been heard, and yesterday, the state prosecutor, white-bearded, tiger-headed, 75-year-old André Mornay, delivered his final speech. When, in the climax, the state prosecutor demanded the death penalty for Pétain, the old marshal's hands touched and played with the military medal hanging on his chest. The verdict will be handed down Tuesday. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
And now, to tell you about a new kind of electric refrigerator that will keep foods fresh and appetizing in uncovered dishes, here is Warren Sweeney.
The huge moist coal compartment in the post-war Admiral dual-temp refrigerator will keep foods fresh and moist without the usual covered dishes. There's always a gentle movement of pure, moist, cold air in the Admiral dual-temp. The air is purified because of the Admiral Sterilamp's ultraviolet ray action that kills bacteria, combats odors, and retards mold growth. The air is moist because of the 85% humidity maintained in the Admiral dual-temp. And the air is cold, always at near 38 degrees, the ideal temperature for preserving unfrozen foods. But your Admiral Dual Temp will really be two refrigerators in one, for Admiral will give you a separate built-in freezing locker that will quick freeze or store frozen foods safely for months. But to see what the Admiral Dual Temp and other Admiral products look like, why not send for the new full-colored booklet called It's a Promise from Admiral. It's easy to get you a free copy. Here's all you do. Simply write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you're now listening. Remember, just your name and address on a penny postcard. Then mail it to Admiral in care of this station. One of America's most urgent manpower needs is for more experienced officers and men with certificates for all merchant marines. Even with the war in the Pacific about over, the task of supplying and bringing home our men still lies before us. America has the ships, but she still needs the men to man them. If you have the experience needed to serve your country in this emergency, apply at once by wiring Collect, Merchant Marine, Washington, D.C. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.